Now, just a little recap here so we remember where we're at. Abram left his hometown of Ur in Mesopotamia after being called by God to go to the Promised Land. And then he crosses the Jordan River into the land of Canaan. Now, his time there so far has not been easy. To try to escape a famine, he ends up going south to Egypt and sent packing right back up north because of a messy situation with the Pharaoh and his wife Sarai. Once back, in an effort to try and make the land better provide for their livestock and people, Abram and his nephew Lot separate. And Abram sets up shop in the hill country of Canaan, around the town of Hebron near an Amorite settlement. And Lot decides to settle in the fertile Jordan Valley near the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's where we're starting this lesson this morning. Abram is a very wealthy, powerful foreigner in this land that God has told him he and his descendants will inherit. But so far, he can only take that as being true based on his faith, because tangibly, there's no physical evidence of that so far. Now, I think when we're reading through Genesis about Abram, it's really easy to get super laser focused in on him as an individual. And this would be completely natural. I mean, he's a pivotal figure in our faith. He's a patriarch. He is the protagonist of the story. But I think in doing so, we lose just a little bit of context of what was actually going on at this time. So before we start with our reading this morning, I want to take a step back. And let's first look at a map and frame in all of our minds what Canaan looked like when Abram got there. So, you can see here, there's a lot of towns, a lot of settlements. There's a lot of different groups that live here. There's the Jebusites, the Perizzites, Amalekites, Amorites, basically a ton of different groups that end in ites. And they have already been set up here for generations. They have histories. They have cultures. They have established settlements. This isn't some desolate scape that Abram is coming in and pioneering. It's not like he's going out and discovering a new world. No, he's a newcomer on the block with a bunch of people already having been there for generations. But how did those people get there to start out with? If we go back a couple chapters in Genesis chapter 9, verse 18, it says, "Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan." Before being a place, Canaan was a person. And that's why it's called the land of Canaan. If we go slightly forward here, we see that Noah gets really mad at his grandson Canaan and curses him. Says, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." So Noah gets super mad at his grandson, does this devastating curse on him. And then if we go forward to the next chapter, we see how then Canaan's descendants end up moving to this area. In chapter 10, it says, "Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth the Jebusite, the Amorite, the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, and the Sinite, the Arvadite, the Zimmerite, and the Hamathite. Afterward, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon as you go towards Gerar, as far as Gaza, then as you go towards Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim, as far as Laisha." So these descendants of Noah's grandson, who's been cursed, end up being the ones that settle this region that Abram is now coming to. The incredible thing here is, if you were just going to read the story of Abram standing alone by itself, you would think that God promising him this land would have started in his lifetime. But in reality, like so many stories in the Bible, it started long, long before. You see, Abram is a descendant of Shem. And it's kind of just the fulfillment of this curse Noah gave that he's going to come and he's going to take this land and inherit it from the descendants of Canaan. Now, we've looked at Canaan, but this isn't the only population center on the map at the time. Let's take one more step back, because there's a lot of other things going on in this ancient world. And we've already seen evidence that there's a lot of other settlements just in Abram's travel so far. I mean, he went south down to Egypt where there's a massive empire and there's the Pharaoh down there in all of his power. And his homeland was up in Mesopotamia. And if we look up there to the north and the northeast, way up there in modern-day Turkey, there's a large conglomeration of Hittite tribes that have settled. If we go farther down the Euphrates and Tigris River to the east in modern-day Iraq, there is the kingdom of Shinar, with its capital city that y'all probably all recognize, Babylon. You know, that's where the Tower of Babel was. If you go to the east of there, there's another kingdom called Elazar in modern-day Iraq and Kuwait, with its capital city of Larsa. And if you go east of there to modern-day Iran, that is the kingdom of Elam, the major superpower of the day. I mean, we all think about Egypt and how they're the great power. Elam was similar. At one point, their sphere of influence spread all the way from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean Sea. They actually springboarded into power after they overtook Abram's hometown of Ur, which we established in previous lessons was a booming metropolis of the day. And as their sphere of influence grew, in pretty much an effort not to be consumed by Elam, some of these other kingdoms just started trying to get in alliances with them so that they just didn't get destroyed. And that's kind of the case here with Shinar and Elazar. They were not on an level playing field with Elam. They were kind of in an alliance being subservient, and Elam could pretty much tell them to do whatever they wanted to do. So with this context in mind of kind of what's going on in the world at the time, and Abram is down here in the land of Canaan, while all these cogs of this machine are moving around, let's dive in to Genesis chapter 14. That holds the first recorded war in biblical history. Before Leonidas and the 300 Spartans, there was Abram and his 318 trained servants. And we're going to go and see what happens. So, reading one more time, like Daryl did an amazing job doing all those hard names earlier, it says, "And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elazar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations." Now, that king of nations, he was kind of the war chief that was leading all the conglomerations of Hittite tribes up in Turkey, "that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemember, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. And all these joined together in the valley of Sidim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled." So, Elam's sphere of influence has gone so far, they are actually in control of at least 5 city-states in the Promised Land right now. That being Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and Zoar. But we talk about kings down here. These weren't kings like these kingdoms mentioned up north. These were kind of kings of their own little city-state. Now, that's not to say they didn't have power or economic sway. It would have just been like those guys up north, they were the king of the United States or the king of Texas, where these guys down here were the king of Decatur and the king of Denton and the king of Louisville. And Elam was pretty much in control of what they were doing. And in an effort to not be consumed by them, they were basically vassal states to Elam, you know, having to regularly send taxes to them to just maintain the status quo. And after 12 years of that, foreign oppression, those people coming down here having influence in their lives that they didn't think was warranted or needed, they decided they had had enough. I mean, we could probably relate to these people. As Americans here, we all understand the saying, no taxation without representation. And we see what we did with that. And this was kind of a similar story. They said, all these kingdoms up north, we don't want them in our lives anymore. And we're going to rebel and we're going to get rid of them. And it's human nature, as all of us, we love a good underdog story, don't we? I mean, look at how famous all of our stories about the American Revolution are. Look at how popular the Star Wars series has been. I mean, they just keep milking that one for all it's worth. We love a good underdog story. But the reason, or one of the reasons those are so popular, is because they're very rare when the underdog is actually successful. Most of the time when a little power goes up against a giant mighty one, they stand no hope. So when the unlikely outcome happens, that little underdog power actually wins, we all get super excited and we love those stories. But let's see if these five kings in Canaan can be as successful. Going on, starting in verse 5. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and attacked the Rephaim and Ashtaroth Carmain, the Zuzim and Ham, the Emim and Shavakarathaim, and the Horites in their mountains of Seir, as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to Enmashpat, that's Kadesh, and attacked all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites who dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. And the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out and joined together in battle in the valley of Sidim against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of nations, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elazar. Four kings against five. Now the valley of Sidim was full of asphalt pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell there, and the remainder fled to the mountains. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. So basically what happened was this giant, massive empires that are coming in to squash this rebellion are coming in from the north, and they're making their way down through the eastern side of the land of Canaan. And it doesn't matter who they come across, whether they're part of the rebellion or not. They're just wiping them off the map. They're squashing them under tow. They're taking all the riches and wealth from those as they go on their way. Because, I mean, if we're already having to travel all this way to squash this rebellion, we might as well get rich doing it, right? And they work their way down south of the Dead Sea, where then they hook back up on their way north to meet those five rebelling kings around the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah. And when they meet there, unfortunately, those underdogs, they didn't fare well. They didn't stand a chance. Just like every settlement that had seen this massive power coming at them before, they were just squashed under tow like a bug. And they were sent running. If they didn't die there, or if they weren't taken as loot in their pillaging, they just ran for the mountains hoping to save their own lives. It kind of reminds me of the Civil War. I don't know if any of y'all remember in class Sherman's March to the Sea. I mean, you could just look back behind him and it was fire and destruction. It didn't matter what was in his way. That was kind of what was happening here. They were just carving their way basically through the majority of Canaan, stealing all the wealth, destroying all the peoples until they came to squash that rebellion. And now it's time to head home. It says in verse 11, then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods and departed. You know, we established earlier when Abram and Lot split, Lot ends up settling over here in this area. And he was a wealthy man, similar to his uncle. So when these people would have came across him, they would say, oh, here's some more stuff to take home with us. And they wrapped them up with their loot and headed north. And unfortunately for them, they chose to mess with the wrong family, because this would be a critical error that could turn the tide of the war. Going on in verse 13, it says, then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol and the brother of Aner. And they were allies with Abram. Now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now we've kind of looked at the world at this time, and if you weren't one of the superpowers of the day, if you wanted to have a chance of your kingdom surviving, you kind of had to enter these alliances. And so far, we've seen this war being between two alliances, and now a third one enters the fray. Abram has set up shop over by these Amorites, and he's actually been able to enter an alliance through negotiations and stuff with these three brothers. And that alliance is about to be put to the test. This guy from the east, he escapes the destruction of that war that's been going on. He says, hey, Abram, guess what? On the other side of the mountains over there, there's crazy battles going on. Everyone's being destroyed, and your nephew has been stolen, along with his family and everything he has. Without thinking twice, Abram looks around. He's like, well, I got 318 trained servants. And I got a couple brothers over here who will probably come help me. And thankfully, they did. And without thinking twice, he jumps into one of the most daring rescue missions of all time. I mean, you've seen what this invading army has been doing. I mean, think of thousands and thousands and thousands of people just coming in, and you're like, oh, I got a few hundred. I mean, probably not even close to the forces these kings have been able to establish, and they got squashed. But he says, you know what? God's on my side. We're going to go after him. We're going to save my family. Now, going on, it says in verse 15, he divided his forces against them by night, and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. So he brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. You see, one good thing about Abram having this smaller task force is they were able to quickly make up ground on this massive army, you know, leaving and heading home drunken on their own successes. And they slowly catch up to them until they get to the town of Dan. And there, Abram decides to strike. Under the cover of night, he divides his forces and in utter panic surprises this camped out invading army that's heading home. I mean, just all of a sudden, everything's peaceful, and then there's deadly projectiles, there's flashing blades, thundering hooves, there's screams of utter death and triumph. And that invading army is caught by surprise. They can't do nothing but take off and retreat. They start heading home. They're running home to their moms. But Abram pursues them. And this isn't just a little pursuit. He doesn't just pursue them for a couple hours, make sure, you know, they get the message. They're not welcome here. No, he pursues them over 50 miles through mountainous terrains. This would have been days that he was chasing them until he got to Hobah. So even once the sun came up and it wasn't dark anymore, this invading army looks back and they're like, hey, our pursuers are kind of not that big of a deal. You'd think they'd be able to regroup and stand their ground. But no, God definitely plays out here the blessings that he'd have for Abraham's allies and the curses he'd have for his enemies. Abram doesn't stop until he gets back all the people and all the loot and all the wealth that's been taken. Then, now he's coming home a war hero. You know, all of a sudden he was this newcomer, new kid on the block that probably would have been looked at with suspicion by his neighbors. But now all of a sudden, he's this guy that probably everyone admired and was talking about. And it says in verse 17, and the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheba, that is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of the God Most High. So he's heading back victorious after this unearthly victory in battle. You know, unless God was on your side, it really doesn't make sense that this even was able to happen. And he's met by two kings on his way home. First, let's talk about the one that we already know in this story, the character we've already established. That's the king of Sodom, Bera. He's had his life turned upside down. I mean, not long ago, he was the king of a city-state. He probably sat on the throne. He was making decisions. And now his kingdom's gone. All the money, all the wealth, all the subjects, all that's been taken from him. But Abram just went and won. He sees a glimmer of hope here, and he's wondering, okay, what can I do here to grasp some of that power I had back? And he comes up with a plan, and he says, you know what? I need to go initiate this conversation with Abram to see what I can get back. Let's see what his proposal was. In verse 21, it says, now the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons and take the goods for yourself. He proposes this as if he's being friendly to Abram. He's doing him a favor, as if he even has the authority to do this at all. You know, they say all's fair in love and war, and the fairness in war was, hey, that invading army took everything from this man. That's theirs now. And then guess what? Abram went and took it from them. So Abram has 100% authority to keep these things. But Bera goes out there and postures, trying to see what he can do. You see, it's hard to be a ruler if you have no one to rule over. So he's like, hey, how about you can keep all those spoils? I'm not worried about that. You did a great job out there. Just give me the people back and let them go home. But we'll see how Abram responds to this. He doesn't sugarcoat his response at all. He says, but Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand to the Lord God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, and that I will not take anything that's yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. except only what the young men have eaten and the portion of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them take their portion. See, Abram sees right through Bera's ploy. But Bera's actually probably feeling good at the beginning of this. It's like, hey, I was just hoping to get the people back, but you say you're not going to keep anything? You're going to give me the people and all the wealth back? This is amazing. Until then, Abram goes on to say, hey, I know you know I'm a powerful person. I'm being blessed by God. My position in this region is growing. I'm doing this because I know your tricky ways. I don't want you to be able to take any credit for my successes. I want only God, everyone to know that only God is the reason I'm being blessed. Only God has given me this power and this position going forward. Let's think about how Abram's life has changed here just in the last few days. He went from being someone that his neighbors would have looked at with suspicion. He's a powerful guy who just kind of moved here, and you know, you got that new neighbor next door that you're not really sure about. And then all of a sudden, he became a war hero. And not only that, he got back everything that had been stolen from you. He might have even gotten back you. And he brought you back, and he didn't keep anything for himself, but let everyone go home. Let them take their goods. Let them take their wealth. He's basically like a Middle Eastern Robin Hood. I mean, they probably would have talked about him, probably would have been saying stories. Now he's a person to be admired. He's a new power figure. He's a war hero, a guy who can win a battle against all odds. And he's coming back with all this wealth. And I think when we think in our heads, I can see why Abram moved the chess pieces that he did. You know, he wants to make sure God's getting all the credit. He wants to not let any earthly man be able to say that he had anything to do with the blessings that God is giving him. We can nod our heads and say, yeah, that makes sense. I can see why he did that. But I think making it so simple, we lose a little bit of context for what actually just happened here. What is it that Abram's actually walking away from right now? I mean, you got to think about it. Abram was concerned that Bera would have tried to take some credit for his wealth if he kept some of the spoils of this war. But Abram was already a very wealthy man. I mean, he would have been a kind of a power player in the area. So it wouldn't make sense that Bera would have claimed wealth to something he already had. It would only make sense if the spoils of this war would have sent Abram to a whole new level. I mean, let's look. Where did this wealth come from? Well, this invading army is some of the major superpowers of the Near East at the time. I mean, kind of like Pharaoh. We talk about Egypt all the time, but these people were right up there with them. All the wealth that they would have brought down in their caravans as they were going to go through this land. And then not only that, they pillaged and looted their way basically through almost every settlement there in Canaan and took all of their wealth too. You got to think how much money they're taking with them. And then they meet those five kings of Canaan, and they take everything from them as well. That is what Abram had just got in possession of. The money, the power, the servants of an empire, not just some little, you know, rinky-dink, ragtag band making their way through the land. This was the riches of five kingdoms, plus the invaders, and basically all of Canaan that he was walking away from. This was the kind of power that could have vaulted him from being a power player to maybe being one of the new superpowers of the Near East. Imagine, you're sitting on the throne of one of the most powerful countries in the world with the authority to say and do whatever you want with nobody saying anything to you. You have so much money and wealth, you can literally buy whatever you can dream up and then probably even more than that. And that is a better description of what Abram is walking away from here. I don't think it'd be hard to say that, in my opinion, this is probably the strongest act of faith Abram has had so far in his life. And it starts to make sense why in the New Testament we see that Abram is referred to as a hero of faith and a friend of God when he's doing things like this. We can see a little bit of indirect evidence of the power this money would have had at the time through a couple of those Amorite allies he had who went on the mission with him. If we look at Mamre the Amorite, after this goes on, continually throughout the book of Genesis, we see reference to places, the Oaks of Mamre, all the way 200 years later in Genesis 35. So this power helped the brother Mamre solidify his position in this region to where he's being talked about and remembered generations later. Even more so, look at the other brother, Eshcol. He's referenced 640 years later in Numbers when the 12 spies go into Canaan. They go to the Valley of Eshcol. This wealth helped him set up and establish himself so well in the region that almost 1,000 years later, people are still referencing him. This wealth and these spoils had amazing power that Abram just walked away from. So that looks at the situation with the first king. Now let's look at this second king that Abram met in the valley. It says in verses 18 through 20, "Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, 'Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand.' And he gave him a tithe of all." Who is this new guy that just popped on the scene? I mean, we've never heard about him before. And apparently he's important enough that Abram goes out there and gives him a tenth of the spoils of the war. I mean, we just established how much money that actually was for a guy you just met. He basically goes out in this valley and has communion with him with bread and wine. Who is this Melchizedek that Abram is meeting with? Well, we can get a little bit more context. About 1,000 years later, King David in Psalms 110 says that Jesus will be a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. And then if we go all the way farther into Hebrews 7, it says, "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met with Abram, returning from the slaughter of the kings, and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being translated king of righteousness, then also king of Salem, meaning king of peace, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually." If you keep reading into that chapter, it goes on to say that for Abraham to be treating this guy with such reverence, he must have been incredibly important, because Abram was the one who all the priests of Levitical priesthood would have came from later. And even Abram is giving reverence to this guy. Now, I think it's a incredibly fascinating mental exercise to try to figure out all these nuances of who Melchizedek is, you know, what he means to our faith. I mean, obviously, he was a very important person who really isn't referenced a whole ton of a lot in the Bible for being so important. But that gets complicated enough, it really deserves its own lesson, or maybe even a couple lessons. So for this lesson focusing on Abram, let's just say what we do know for sure about him. He was a king of Salem, which would eventually become Jerusalem. He was a high priest of God, despite not being a member of God's chosen people. And he set up a model for Christ to follow thousands of years later. Now, I think we can all pull a very powerful lesson from this that we can apply to all of our lives. When Abram met with Melchizedek, he interpreted that as meeting with or having an interaction with a representative of God. And we've seen who all of a sudden Abram is. Abram is this power player in the region. He just went and won a war. He's a war hero that he shouldn't have been able to win. And now he's coming back, basically probably being a folk hero at this point, and he walks away from the wealth of nations. He's a very important, powerful, influential guy in the region. And despite all of this, he's still showing respect and subservience to God. We can read in Deuteronomy, Moses said, "Then you say in your heart, 'My power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth.' And you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the power to get the wealth." It doesn't matter how big we get, how powerful we are, how many zeros we have in our bank account, what accolades we've accomplished, what rank we get, what trophies we've won. It doesn't matter what we do on this earth or who we become. God always has to come first. Going on, I think we can learn something else from this story, that God can do a whole lot with very, very little. I mean, look, we just saw and his 318 trained servants, along with these couple Amorite brothers, go up and whoop this massive invading army who has been destroying everybody in their path and send them running for home. We can see a similar story with Gideon. I mean, with a much smaller force, Gideon is able to prevail against a mighty foe. We can see David, with just a tiny little stone, destroy the giant Goliath. And we can see Jesus, with just 5 loaves and 2 fish, was able to fill the stomachs of a great crowd. God can do a lot with very little. He can make a giant output with very minimal input. In 1 Corinthians 1:27, it says, "But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty." I think we need to be very careful in our own lives not to prematurely judge what God can and can't use. Because, I mean, even the faith the size of a mustard seed can move mountains. You might not think that just going and inviting that coworker to church or just talking to your peer and having a spiritual conversation can do much, but man, Sean was just here for a whole gospel meeting where he gave basically 1,000 examples of how that little drop in the bucket can create a huge ripple effect and have massive power. You might not think that little bit of money you can scrape up can really do much when you put it in the offering plate. But God can do a whole lot with very little. You know, you might not think that you, how you sit here today, have much to offer this congregation. Maybe you don't think you have much to offer God. But God can do a whole lot with very little. And don't prematurely decide not to give the little because you don't think it's enough. There's one more thing I want to look at the story from this morning. And that's that, once again, we can be confident that all this is real, all this is the truth, and we can have confidence in our faith. You know, the last lesson, we looked at a few examples of biblical archaeology and how they really help reinforce and establish that everything we're reading in this the book, the Bible, it's all true. It's historical events that actually happened. It's not fairy tales. It's not from the fiction section. It's not something conjured up in an effort to control a population of people. These are all actual facts, actual things that have happened. And I think we can pull another affirmation from our faith from examples in this story. And that's the unworldly consistency of narrative. I mean, just in this one chapter, we've seen Noah curse his grandson, and then that play out through Abram hundreds of years later. And we've established how Melchizedek is setting up a model that thousands of years later, Christ will follow. Fulfilled prophecies, interwoven stories, histories and messages, spanning over 1,500 years, written by a multitude of authors, all melding together into a perfect, uncontradicting scripture. Something that no scripture inspired by man could ever come close to and never has. The incredible consistency of narrative and Bible on it, of the Bible on its own can be an affirmation to our faith. Because the only explanation, as 2 Timothy says, is that it must be God-breathed. Now this morning, as we've looked at this next step in Abram's life, you might be struggling. Maybe you're struggling with pride because of the things you've accomplished. You've learned to lean on yourself and be independent instead of leaning on God and being dependent on Him. Or maybe you're on the opposite side. Maybe you don't feel like you've accomplished a lot. Maybe you don't feel like you have much to give. And you don't think God could do much for you. Well, the great thing is that you came to church today.